Hey everybody, welcome to episode 10 of Boy Meets Tech. Very excited to be launching the 10th episode. And this week we are joined by Kenneth Aldrich, who over the last 45 years has been an investor in numerous different companies and startups, including large companies like Green Dot. He's also started a few companies and sold them on his own. He's a wealth of knowledge, is really going to touch base on what entrepreneurs need to know about investing, what they need to know about starting their own business, and just touch on a host of different subjects. He just released his first book, The Dream Toolbox, and we were lucky enough to get a few minutes of his time this week, and I really hope you enjoy this new episode.
I started out not in the VC world at all. I started out trained as a lawyer, practiced law for a few years, then moved through a chain of circumstances into the investment banking world, set up a real estate operation for an investment banking firm, and then ultimately migrated into the role of chief legal and financial officer for a real estate investment trust. After that market imploded many years ago, I decided that it was time to go on my own and started figuring out how to become an entrepreneur instead of an employee, which made all the difference in the world in my life, quite frankly. And at that point, started in the real estate business, which is what I knew best. Bought and sold apartment properties from my own account, stable of investors, because I really didn't have any money of my own, so I had to find investor money. And we did fairly well over a period of about 10 years, went from buying a few apartment buildings, actually from buying and selling some beach properties in Malibu back before house flipping became a term. But then ultimately ended up forming an alliance with some partners, and we built a 30-story office building, which we successfully sold to a Japanese investment group. And it actually withstood the 93-94 earthquake here in California. So that was an interesting career, but in the mid-80s, the rules of the game for real estate changed after the savings and loan crisis. So after that, I looked around and said, where can I get leverage so that I don't have to raise a huge pool of capital, but can still do larger deals and potentially make a lot of money? And the answer to me was early-stage venture capital, because it didn't take a lot of money to start. There was a fairly high failure rate, as there always is in that business, but you could start over, and when you hit a success, you could have a really big one.
And was that as popular as it is today in terms of early stage venture and seed and, you know, pre-seed and all of the different kind of brackets you have now?
No, it wasn't nearly as popular. In fact, seed investing, or what I call professional angel investing, was pretty much in its infancy in, you know, prior to about the very late 1900s, just around the 2000 market crash. There was some, but when I first joined an angel group, for example, there were only about 50 of us, and there are now over 200 in that group alone, and several other major angel investing groups in the LA area. So the field was less crowded. It was in some ways easier, but in many ways it was more difficult because it was so unknown that getting second and third rounds of financing became more difficult.
Okay. And then kind of where were you kind of your first, you know, hits or misses kind of as you entered that kind of field?
Well, the first ones, frankly, were misses. There's a learning curve to everything. But one of the things I had learned was not to put all my eggs in one basket and always to look at what could go wrong and make sure that I could survive the worst that I thought could happen and go forward. So the first one or two companies that I sponsored were led by good people, but we didn't, frankly, understand our market or the marketing strategies that later became obvious. And both of those companies were folded. But then I invested in a company that turned out to be wonderful, produced ultimately over a 10-year period, 150-to-1 return on investment, which is pretty spectacular. Most VCs will tell you that if they get a 10-to-1 return, they consider it a home run. And many, of course, don't get anywhere near that. So that was a huge help. The other thing that happened to me during that period is that I went from being an investor in other people's projects to including creating my own. So that happened over time, and I began to realize that I didn't like being totally dependent on other people for whether a project succeeded or failed. So I ended up with various partners forming over a period of a decade, about 10 different companies, only one of which actually went out of business. We closed it down. The other 10 were successful, either in the sense that we developed technology, which we were able to sell, or developed a company that we could ultimately take public, or a company that we could ultimately sell. So it was a great experience for me. I didn't like running companies, quite frankly. I liked the investment side better. So I continued to invest, and I probably invested in 50 or more different companies that I don't control, in addition to the 10 that I did. So it was a nice mix, because what I learned from being in the operations side paid off handsomely when I was trying to evaluate investments, because I could more quickly figure out which operators had a chance of success and which ones didn't.
And do you kind of, are you wary of investors who kind of go straight into the investing or VC model versus, you know, having, you know, starting a company, having a successful exit? Is that something to be wary of as a startup owner?
No, not necessarily. I think to a certain extent, anyone who applies the right mental attitudes and the right focus can be an entrepreneur if they have the willingness to do it and the desire to do it. And part of that is the acceptance of the fact that the failure of an enterprise or of a project that you may start doesn't mean you have failed. It simply means that that particular idea needed tweaking, or maybe needed to be set aside and another thing taken up. I'll give you an example. There's a company that just went public called Beyond Meats, and I think it's up about 400% from where it originally debuted, at least 200%. And they basically create organic meat substitutes, and it's apparently a huge success. 10 years ago, two people approached me, actually just one person now that I think about it, approached me with essentially the same idea of growing meat artificially in a petri dish, if you will, and making it taste like real beef. Well, they were just ahead of their time. The idea was sound, the concept was good, but the market wasn't there right for it. And so that company was put on the shelf, and ultimately I did not put money into it, and the founders did not go forward with it, went on to start several other successful companies. So partly it's market timing, partly it's market research. And you have to be prepared to both ride the successes all the way to the finish line, but also recognize if you've guessed wrong and step aside, because timing and markets can change.
And I think that, you know, I'm pretty comfortable with that company. And I mean, we've supported them for a long time. It's crazy to kind of see that movement for kind of the artificial meat category. But I'd love to also touch on kind of, which I believe you have told me in the past, is kind of your biggest success, which is Green Dot. And just kind of understanding, you know, what that company is, your role in that company, and kind of the arc of how that company, you know, went from, you know, seed round investing to now on the stock exchange.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. That's a remarkable success story. Green Dot was brought to me when I was an active member of the Tech Coast Angels here in Los Angeles. And a friend of mine brought it in and said, you've got to meet this young founder, Steve Street. And I said, gee, I just back from a safari in Africa, and the last thing I wanted to do was to look at another deal until I got over jet lag. She said, no, please come to a meeting. So I went to the meeting, was enormously impressed with the energy and the focus of what was then a young founder. And so I said, okay, I'll help put this together. So we did our homework on the company and scrabbled together a round of financing. I think the Angels brought in about $800,000, and Steve, through his own contacts, brought in an equivalent amount from other sources. And the company was started with, as I recall, about $1.8 million. And the concept was that teenagers had no ability to buy on the internet. They had to use their parents' credit cards, or they couldn't do anything because they were underage and couldn't get a card. So what Steve wanted to do was to create a card that was looked like a MasterCard, which was the first model, or a Visa card, but was a prepaid debit card. And banks all had debit cards at that time. But you, again, had to have a bank account, had to be over 18, and it just didn't work for the kids. So the idea was you could take your allowance, you could go into the Rite Aid was the first retail outlet, spend your allowance, buy a card, and then take that card and shop on the internet, or take your date out to dinner and look like a big guy. So that was the concept. And we raised the money and started. Then a very interesting thing happened. We realized, and that is to say Steve realized, I was on his board and have been ever since, that the youth market that we thought was going to be the key was really only a small part of the market, and frankly not a big enough part to have built a successful company on. The real market was people who were, as we call them, underbanked or unbanked. That could be for a variety of reasons. They couldn't get a bank account because of bad credit, or they distrusted banks, which was often the case. We set about to retool the company and go after a different market. And that's where Steve, as the CEO, proved so brilliant. He was able to see that the market was limited, able to see a different market, and then figure out, he had some good people around him, ways to penetrate that market. And the ultimate breakthrough was persuading Walmart to provide the cards in the Walmart stores, because the demographics were perfect. The Walmart customer earns somewhere between $50,000 and $75,000 a year, frequently does not have a bank account or has one that's very expensive. And Steve was able, with the aid of some of the very good people that he had hired, to open up that account. And Walmart became the biggest customer and the basis for building the entire company. Then one other thing happened that I think is important. Many things happened, obviously, but the next step was really a critical one, which was to realize that just selling debit cards was not enough. We needed to convert Green Dot from being a seller of debit cards to a full-on financial technology company, which it now is. It's on the New York Stock Exchange and doing extraordinarily well. But it took each of those steps and transitions to make all of that happen. And the key to that was a leader who was adaptive, aware of his market, a good marketer, but also a very good administrator. And that's what you look for if you're investing in this field. They don't come along very often, and you often have to start with someone who's has some of the skills, and then if you're a good investor, help them augment those skills. So it's rare and wonderful when you find someone that can carry the ball all the way to the finish line.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great too as an investor, because then that one investment kind of returns your entire portfolio, right?
Well, that's true. It's by no means my whole portfolio. It's a relatively small part, but it's still a significant part today. And I've sold off and given away, you know, millions of dollars worth of shares in Green Dot over time. But the VCs will tell you, if you talk to them and they answer candidly, that they expect a high failure rate in early stage companies. And they're not turned off, nor am I, by an executive who has started a company that didn't make it, because you, quite frankly, you learn more from your mistakes than you do from some of your successes. That executive is probably less likely to make fatal mistakes than someone who's gotten lucky in their first round and now they think they know it all. So you have to assess those characteristics. But it's very much a game of recognizing the ones that do not work, cutting your losses early, recognizing those that are working and putting the resources behind them to let them succeed. I mean, Green Dot started with $1.8 million, but ultimately raised, you know, many millions of dollars more by the time they became a public company. It's a process, not a one-time event.
And when you're looking at really, the startup and the founder and the team, and when you're making an investment, what's really the main decision maker for you?
I think passion is probably the biggest single thing. And by that, I don't mean passion to get rich, but it's a passion to create something, to do something that nobody has ever done before, or nobody's ever done it as well before. And that sort of burning desire to do something special. The money will follow. And I, you know, you don't want the inventor who's off in the clouds. You want somebody who can be practical and say, okay, this is how we get from point A to point B and get to the ultimate fulfillment of our dreams. But it's without the passion to make it happen. Very few entrepreneurs, I think, succeed because they run into bumps in the road. And one of the things that I wrote about in the book that I've just published called Dream Toolbox is that the true entrepreneur sees barriers in the road not as barriers, not as insurmountable obstacles, but rather sees those barriers as puzzles to be solved. And once you start thinking about things that way, the world changes for you, whether you're working inside a company or whether you're starting a company. If you realize that almost every obstacle can be reconstructed, you can go over it, you can go under it, you can go around it, but one way or another, usually there's a solution. And often, if you solve the problem, you have then created room to grow because other people have run up against the same barrier and stopped. So obstacles are not necessarily a bad thing. They're part of the process of becoming a good entrepreneur.
And would you say that's kind of the biggest mistake that you see startup entrepreneurs doing, not being able to figuring out those issues that kind of come up?
Well, I don't want to say that it's the biggest mistake, but it's a mindset issue. You know, Henry Ford had the saying, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. So if you believe that you can solve almost any problem that's put in front of you and really have that embedded in your core belief system, you probably can. Now, there's an exercise that I try to coach people to do. And again, I did that in length in writing the book, which is to take a look before you start and say, all right, let's lean over the abyss here and look and see what is the absolute worst thing that could happen if I'm wrong. And can I survive it? Can my marriage survive it? Can my life survive it? All of those questions. The answer is usually yes, quite frankly. There are very few things in the economic world that you, particularly if you're young, that you can't look at and say, you know, even if I'm totally wrong about this, I can start over, I can start with a new idea, but if I'm right, wow, I can change the world. Or I can change my segment of it. But I think looking at that worst case gives you enormous confidence because it tends to eliminate one of the biggest things that causes businesses to fail. And that's the fear of failure. Because once, as an entrepreneur, you start worrying about, oh, what if I fail? What if I don't make it? You're dead. You're doomed. You have to look on life as saying, yes, I can solve this. Somehow I will make this happen. Because I believe in the dream and I believe I'm right.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I mean, the thing that's super important. I mean, what I've learned over the last 7 months is just the emotional highs and emotional lows. If you can't stay even, it's definitely, it's very tough to difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult to deal with that.
Well, it is, but it goes back though to you have, if you've succeeded in that, and I happen to know enough to think that you are succeeding, you have internalized a core belief that yes, I can do that. And that is enormously valuable. And it's not arrogance. It's just a core belief that, okay, whatever life throws at me in this, there's probably a solution to it somewhere. I suspect, but I don't know, but I strongly suspect that the iPhone didn't succeed in its first iteration. I know that the MacBook almost didn't succeed. And certainly we've all heard the story of Thomas Edison who tried 1,000 times before he got a working light bulb. So it's a mindset that's more important than almost anything else. I call it the entrepreneurial mind. And it's just a way of looking at the world without fear, having looked at the worst that can happen and say, yeah, I can deal with that, but I don't intend to. I intend to succeed instead.
Yeah, no, I think that's crucial, especially for any, you know, entrepreneur mindset that's going to take this plunge, and just to understand that, you know, those roadblocks aren't roadblocks. They're just, like you said, puzzles to really put together and figure out the best way to move forward. I know you had kind of touched base a little bit, but I'd love to kind of end on kind of going over the Dream Toolbox and kind of, you know, what it is. I know it's kind of a summation of your entire career really being put into this book. I just kind of like to know a little bit about the book and kind of, you know, what you're doing with regards to that moving forward.
Well, I'd be glad to tell you the book grew out of experience that I had as a mentor in inner city high schools, trying to teach young people about entrepreneurship. And what I found was an interesting thing, and that is that I could spend all semester with 30 or 40 kids, and if I was really lucky, one or two might suddenly see the light that, you know, hey, there really is a job beyond putting in my 30 years at Walmart or defining my career by, would you like fries with that order? There is a different way. But the other thing I discovered was more important, and that was that often the thing that made that difference for those students was one chance comment, one explanation, one example that would have what I call a flash moment, a revelation moment. So I said, okay, then it becomes a numbers game. How can I reach more than 30 people in one semester? How can I reach a lot more? And I started out by creating a series embedded in the website that is still very much alive and operating called dreamtoolbox.com. And those were little 4-minute audio blogs about different aspects of entrepreneurism. Well, then my friends persuaded me that that's all well and good, but if you really want to reach a lot of people, you got to write a book. So I wrote a book and I took those, and I'm very glad I did, because I took those nucleus principles, and as I began to write about it and began to expand on those, I realized there were a lot more dimensions than I had really thought about when I was just writing 4-minute blogs. So the net result is a book, not a particularly big book. It's about 200 and some odd pages. And it's not a how-to book. It isn't the nuts and bolts of here's how you form a corporation, here's how you do a business plan, et cetera. I talk a little bit about those things. But the basic one is, how do you change the core belief system? How do you take a dream and so visualize it and so imagine it that it becomes real in your mind? And then when it's real in your mind and embedded deeply in your own subconscious, your brain takes over and you make it a reality. I had that happen to me. I know it can happen. And I've seen it happen many, many times. But it starts with visualizing the dream that you really want, knowing that it's one that inflames your passions, and then embedding that so deeply in your subconscious that everything you do one way or another leads toward that ultimate goal. And that's not as hard as it sounds, but I did spend a lot of time on the aspirational parts of that, as well as some exercises and drills and some tricks of the trade, if you will, to get to that point so that you look at almost everything as an opportunity. I think it was Rahm Emanuel, who was the former mayor of Chicago when he was a political operative in Washington, you know, was famous for saying, never waste a crisis, because inside them, there's usually an opportunity.
Yeah, and I had an opportunity to read the book a little earlier, and you know, I thought it was a lot of very actionable tools that you kind of put into place in your everyday life. And I'll definitely include a link to the book on this podcast. And I'd love to just kind of finish up here with kind of what excites you the most about the future of, you know, startups or technology, or is there any specific sector that's really exciting you right now?
Well, I think there are several sectors from an investment point of view and from a societal point of view that are almost destined to be pivotal in the next decade or beyond. One is one that I'm already actively involved in, which is healthcare and medical devices and biotech. There's no question that we're on the cusp of changing the world, changing our view of longevity, which will in turn change how we view economics and the political systems and everything else. So that's one. The other, which I understand a lot less about, is artificial intelligence, but it's here to stay. And it will also, I think, change the way we look at the world. And I could, you know, go on in other areas, but I think probably those are the two biggest. And they may, they will converge in many, many ways as forward-thinking people like, you know, Kurzweil and others have talked about.
Yeah.
The other thing that if I have a moment more that I would mention is I think that understanding and building entrepreneurial instincts and beneath that a core financial literacy is enormously important for this country and the world, because we live in a period in which I think many people, particularly younger people, feel that there's kind of nothing that they can do and that they have to kind of wait for somebody to help bail them out, if
right.
you will. And the reality is that there's never been so many opportunities for young people. And it's a function of understanding that things that you get for free are never free, because you always give up something, and that something you give up is the freedom to create something yourself and know that you've created it and that you've put your heart and soul in it and succeeded. So I'm hoping that the book and some of the things in there will also change the outlook of some young people and some others, say, wait a minute, it doesn't matter what the politics today are, it doesn't matter what anything is, I can succeed in this world. I can do it on my own with the help of friends, and there's all kinds of resources available. So it isn't that there's no help, but ultimately I've got to take responsibility for my own life. And guess what? I can.
Yeah. I think it goes back to the kind of the Warren Buffett kind of quote of, you know, the current generation that's born in the U.S. is always, you know, the luckiest generation to be born. I mean, there's definitely a ton of opportunity out there. It's just, you kind of got to go out there and get it for yourself.
Absolutely. We are an incredibly wealthy generation in terms of opportunity. Forget financial wealth. We have opportunities that did not exist, you know, a century ago, much less 20 years ago. In fact, a century or so ago, you know, 90% of the world's population was in poverty in the developed world, what is now the developed world. Today, only 10% is in poverty and 90% live in relative affluence. We forget those things. But that means that the opportunity is there for everybody who is willing to think creatively and work hard and build the skills that they need to succeed. And there are skills, but they're skills that can be learned.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's a great place to kind of wrap it up. And Ken, we'll definitely link to the book. And I really appreciate your time today. And always, you know, you kind of continued guidance and both what we're doing here with WeStock. And I know everybody else is going to find it super valuable here on this podcast. So I appreciate that.
Well, Cameron, it's a pleasure to have been on the podcast, and I appreciate your interest, and certainly hope that there will be some people who will read the book and that it might even change their lives. So good luck to everybody, and thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks so much, Ken. Have a good one.
I hope you all enjoyed the latest episode of Boy Meets Tech. As usual, we are brought to you by WeStock. WeStock is the best place to discover and support new and emerging CPG brands. You can find out more at WeStock.io or download the WeStock app in the App Store today. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.